The Big Ten's lawyers bully the University of Nebraska's football team into submission. Okay, I'm guessing this battle didn't actually occur on the football field. Kamala Harris is apparently already on the clock trying to vet her possible VP candidates. Yeah, watch your back, Biden. And the DOJ sends a letter to Yale University saying they are discriminating against Asian Americans in their admissions process. All of this in this week's Debriefing of the Law. Welcome to this week's Debriefing of the Law. I am Joel Oster, your host, and Mackenzie Smith. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me again.
Each week we try to debrief the law for our listeners. There is a lot going on in the world around us, and it takes lawyers to try to figure it out because the law impacts absolutely every aspect of your life. So, Mackenzie, let's just start with, are you wearing a mask today?
Currently I'm in my office with the door closed, so I'm not at the moment, but yes, I mean, every time I go out in public, I am always wearing one, which includes, in the hallways and in more public areas of my office. Yes.
But so I'm just curious, you go to Walmart and then you leave Walmart. How soon are you ripping that mask off? Is it as soon as you pass the exit doorway, or is it hanging on your ear even before that? When do you actually, free yourself from that very oppressive mask?
Well, objection assumes facts, not in evidence. So I'm not going right. to Walmart because I actually went there with my 1-year-old about a month ago, and nobody in the store was wearing a mask. It made me feel very, I'm not a really, I don't want to say uptight, but like I'm not a, I don't feel like unsafe in a lot of situations, but I actually, it's been the only time since the beginning of this pandemic that I really felt uncomfortable. There were a lot of people in the store and hardly anyone was wearing a mask, including employees. And I actually left a cart with items and I left the store. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Mackenzie, I am floored here because you said assumes facts, not evidence, which meant I said something that I had failed to establish. And I thought it was masks were objectionable. No, it was. You went to Walmart. I'm so sorry for describing you as a Walmart kind of person. But nonetheless, I get you. We've entered into a new realm. I was at a tennis match a couple weeks ago, and a guy just came up to me on the street and started talking to me. And I was like, dude, back up. You can't just come up and talk to someone, not in today's day and age. So, yeah, we live in a different world.
Yeah, there's definitely new social rules. And, as far as, how soon after you leave a building do you take off your mask? I mean, it's very hot and humid here on the East Coast right now. So wearing a mask outside is extremely uncomfortable. And I generally don't do it. The only situation where I would wear a mask outside is if I were in a, large crowd of people where I couldn't stay 6 feet apart. But that really hasn't happened. And I propose that we treat the mask zone as we would treat like a smoking zone. So you know how there's regulations that don't smoke within 30 feet of entrance. So I would say let's use that same sphere for masks. So you're walking towards a building, you're walking across the parking lot, you're okay. You get about 30 feet away, slap the mask on, you're good.
As for me, I walk around with my tape measure and it's at 6 foot, 1 inch. So as soon as I'm clear, that mask is coming off. No, in all seriousness, why is it that mask has been politicized? I got to admit, I am a conservative, and you are a liberal, and I know I'm working on you. But nonetheless, I don't understand the conservative viewpoint on why wearing a mask is a political statement. I just don't get it. Now, from a liberal perspective, do you have any idea why that is the case?
I mean, I just think that it's maybe individualism gone awry. And, you know, okay. I do have libertarian, what I would consider to be libertarian views on certain issues. I think it's, you know, pretty issue specific when it comes to me. So, but I do understand like a libertarian mindset and stance. And
right,
you can be intellectually honest and be a libertarian. But also, you know, we aren't like, this goes back to the Old Testament, right? Like, we don't exist in a bubble. And at some, even if you're a libertarian, like at some point you are your brother's keeper, and like, you don't want to be the last man on earth, because then we're extinct. So, you know, at some, there is a line somewhere where you do have a responsibility to others in your community with whom you interact, however briefly. And I would say that, you know, mask wearing, I actually had this conversation with my stepson this morning, because we got in the car to go to camp, and the camp is like maybe half a mile from our house. It's a very brief car ride. And he said, well, I'm not going to buckle my seatbelt because it's only 2 minutes away. And I said, like, we're not leaving the driveway until you buckle your seatbelt. If you're in a moving vehicle, you put your seatbelt on. And it, we kind of went back and forth. And I said, look, does it cost you anything to buckle your seatbelt? No. So if even there's a remote chance that we would get in a crash, it doesn't cost you anything. It doesn't hurt you to put your seatbelt on.
Right.
It could be saving your life, or you could be, you know, saving yourself from harm. It's like wearing a mask. It doesn't cost you anything. It's super easy. You just put it on. You could be saving yourself and others. And then I went on, I took it one step further, and I said, look, it's not like anyone's asking you to cut your left arm off to save my life. And he said, well, just so you know, I wouldn't do that because I'm going to need that arm when I'm in the NFL. So I said, well, at least you're honest. At least I know where you stand.
Hey, he's not getting the extra cookie for snack time, I guess. I don't know. But no, your seatbelt analogy, I think, is right on. In fact, I even mentioned that this last week. I was just kind of, you know, being satirical, I guess. And you know what? I'm done wearing my seatbelt. No, the government can't tell me to wear my seatbelt. I mean, come on. This is personal autonomy. By the way, if you look at the statistics in my lifetime, I have yet to actually need that seatbelt. And I am saying, let's get rid of these wrinkled clothes, because whenever I wear that seatbelt in the heat, it causes sweat marks and my shirts get wrinkled. And so I am done wearing seatbelts. Of course, I'm just kidding. But nonetheless, I just do not get the argument that wearing mask is some kind of political statement, or it's some kind of violation of my liberty interest. I don't know. I just don't get it. But I did venture out this week. Have you ventured out to the to do anything that you would have done before the pandemic? Have you gotten to that point yet with your life?
So, I mean, I do the shopping for my family, the grocery shopping. So I've been doing that the whole time, and I have been coming back into the office. But again, like, I have an office where I can just come in and close the door. And, you know, other than the HVAC system, I really have no contact with anyone else. But I am going out to dinner tomorrow night. We're eating.
Really?
Yes, we're eating outside. Okay. So we're not indoor dining, but we're eating outside at a restaurant. So that is a big step forward.
Is.
And then, you know, all of our kids are starting school in a couple weeks. So that'll be the next thing.
What's going to be the food? If this is going to be your maiden voyage post-pandemic out to a restaurant, what are you going to be dining on?
We are having dim sum, and I'm really excited.
Whoa, what?
We're having dim sum? Yeah.
What the heck is that?
Dim sum is like, you know what tapas is?
No, back up even more.
This is...
I'm from the Midwest here. You're talking just gibberish. Enlighten me. I thought you guys ate Philly cheesesteaks.
Okay, yeah, no, and they're awesome. I have no problem with cheesesteaks. Dim sum is like, it's Chinese, like appetizers, small plates that you kind of share with the table.
Oh, all right. I want to go back to the Chinese buffet. I love the Chinese buffet. I'm just a little nervous, not quite there yet, but I ventured out this last week back to the comedy club. First time I've been there in 5 months. I used to go to do open mic night on a weekly basis. Took 5 months off, so a lot of us comedians that We do this these comedy clubs and open mic nights to kind of work on our material. So it was a great night to be there at open mic night because we all had 5 months to just write and work. And so it was a great night of comedy. At least to us it was. We entertained ourselves, I guess. But that was my first venture out to at least some kind of club public setting, and it's been about 3 days. I'm still feeling quite good. So, hey, you and I had a conversation off air that I want to revisit because I found it was a fascinating conversation. This is what we talked about, and I hope I'm making you just a little bit nervous. But here's the conversation we had. What would we do or not do for money? Right now, in the world of law, which you and I exist in, this is a relevant question, and sometimes we are identified with our clients. But I have to admit, you took it to a whole other level. So I need to get some clarification on the record. Did you really say you would eat an eyeball for money?
I said I would eat an eyeball that derives from any organism other than a human being for $1 million. And if there's anyone out there who wants to call me on this and offer me $1 million, I will do it. So come find me.
We will do that. We will record that. That will be our first venture into YouTube. We will definitely have to get that on tape. But yeah, not a human eyeball. At least you have some standards there. But if it's a cat, maybe a dog, you know, whatever, for $1 million, you would eat an eyeball for $1 million. All right.
Yeah, and it's got to be fresh. Like, I don't want it to pose like a serious risk to my life. I mean, maybe we're getting too far in the weeds now. Like, but if this is going to happen, and it has to be, you know, clean and fresh.
I am sorry. You just, I pick myself back up off the floor here. It has to be fresh. That's where you draw the line.
Well, I don't want it to be a rancid eyeball.
Oh, this eyeball is like 3 days old. No, I want a fresh eyeball. I have no idea what you guys do there in Pennsylvania. Clearly, you need to get back out there, and this pandemic is having an effect. And so let's jump right in now to debriefing the law. This last week, I got to tell you, Mackenzie, I need therapy. Do you have any experience with therapy?
I plead the fifth. Sometimes I feel like I am a therapist in my job, though. I can
Good.
Tell you that.
I need some help here. I need some help. I am in a depressed state because my beloved Nebraska Cornhuskers, they just really disappointed me this week. So let's start off with here with the Big Ten decided to cancel, or they say postpone, whatever. It's cancel the college football season by a vote of 12-2 amongst their presidents of the various Big Ten universities. They voted to cancel the upcoming season. Now, Mackenzie, this has devastated my life. Did you have an initial reaction when you heard this news? Does this impact you?
No, like this does not impact me in any way, shape, or form. I do not watch college football. So it doesn't impact me personally. However, when I heard about this, I gotta say, you know, it did really, you know, I have three kids going back to school in a couple of weeks, and they're not college age kids, but you know, I can kind of sympathize with the disappointment of a college athlete who's worked so hard, and you know, you only have a couple
seasons life.
To play, right? And you only have a couple seasons to play, and maybe some of them are looking to get recruited to play professional sports, and you know, you only got a couple chances. So this makes a huge impact on their lives, and it is really upsetting.
Now, it's upsetting to me, and by the way, I think you make a great therapist, great empathy there for me. You started off kind of hard by saying, Jill, I don't really care about this, but then you softened up your approach just a bit, so I started to feel a little bit of empathy from you. Thank you for that, but yeah, I was really bummed because at first, Nebraska, our coach, Scott Frost, came out and said, this is ridiculous. We will continue to look for opportunities to play college football, even outside of the Big Ten. And when I heard that, I was like, yes, you go, Scott Frost. You tell the Big Ten exactly where to stick it. Because I think that this decision to cancel college football was made out of fear of lawyers. That is my take. I believe this was done not out of the best interest of the kids. In fact, if you listen to the experts, and so the doctors, the people in the know-how, the people who have the closest interaction with these college students, it is pretty well established that they would be safest inside of a college football program. Here's how that thinking goes. And by the way, Jim Harbaugh, the coach from the University of Michigan, said the same thing. Ryan Day, the coach for Ohio State University, said the exact same thing. But when you are inside the structure of a college program, you have motivation, you're encouraged to stay away from the party atmosphere, to make sure you stay healthy and safe, because that way you can continue to play football. They live in somewhat of a quasi-bubble zone. And so, for example, McKinsey, University of Michigan, these are their numbers. Jim Harbaugh said that they had had 11 positive tests out of 893. Now, right there, I don't know if you think that's good or bad, but they said, we've got to do better. So then they had two out of the last 417. Getting better yet, and then zero out of the last 353 tests that have been administered. And so they have found out a way to go about doing college football and have a zero out of 353 tests administered. So McKinsey, what is your take on, do you think that these students would be safer inside of a college football program or just outside of the college football program left to their own devices?
No, I definitely agree with you on that point. And it's my understanding that at least a couple of these schools are going to keep the athletes in the so-called bubble during right. what would otherwise be the season, because that is in their best interest. And if they're going to play a season in the spring, you know, they don't want anyone getting sick or getting, you know, even out of the lifestyle now, like, let's just keep it going. And I do agree with that. I also think, you know, you don't want, it's much more dangerous for students who are boarding at any, you know, whether it be a boarding school for high school or a college, who are away from home, to be in a group, you know, living situation and then go back to their homes and right. potentially expose their families. I definitely think it's better for them to stay on campus once they're there. Also, I mean, I would imagine, and I'm not a doctor, I'm not an epidemiologist, but I would imagine that college athletes are at very low risk of serious illness or death.
Yes.
So,
you're absolutely right.
And they are adults too. They're adults. So they should also have some say in what they are exposing their own bodies to, because they are adults. You know, and I also agree with you that I have to imagine that a big part of this decision-making process had to do with litigation adversity. And, you know, I think
they're afraid of lawyers.
Yes. And I think the question that we should be asking ourselves at this point is whether we as a society have gone too far in allowing litigation or the risk of litigation to shape our choices proactively and to, you know, shape our behavior. And in this situation, I mean, the answer might be yes. And I know that, like, there are plenty of sports leagues in Europe that have been playing for a month or two now. And, you know, there's no fans. It's weird. My son follows European soccer, so we've been watching the Champions League, and it is a completely different viewing experience. But hey, they're out there, they're playing. It's good for morale. It's good for the country. Like, it's, sports really do have the potential to bring people together. And I know that sounds, you know, idealistic, but it's true, man. I mean, there was a great story in European soccer, if you're interested at all, but, as you know, Northern Italy was hit very hard by the COVID pandemic. And, it happened to be, there's a team called Atalanta, which is from right outside Milan. And they were like a lower tier team. And then this year, out of nowhere, they just kind of, you know, within the past year or two, became a force, and they made it into the Champions League. And a couple of days ago, they lost in a quarterfinal match to Paris. But I mean, it was really this inspiring story. Some of the players had lost people in their lives to the pandemic, and to be able to get back on the field and play at such a high level, I mean, it was really emotional and really good for the morale of the community. So I think there's a lot that's been lost here, unfortunately.
And you mentioned a lot of things I wanted to pay attention to. Number one, every student, they would make their own decision. So they can all decide, you know what, this is too much for me. I don't want to take this risk. I'm not going to play football. They would still have their eligibility. They would still have their scholarship. So it's not like anyone would be participating who did not want to participate. Also, the statistics show that when we're talking about college-age kids, there's almost zero risk for them out there. They are just not in any kind of risk category whatsoever. And so why this decision? I think it's because they're afraid of lawyers. They're afraid of losses. They are afraid of the unknown. And so sometimes I think that is a negative on our society in general, that people are afraid of lawyers. We are making decisions, hurting lives, hurting people's opportunities, squashing their dreams because we're afraid of a lawsuit. And so I do think that is not a positive development. McKenzie, I think this really is legal bullying. They're afraid of the lawsuit. Another thing I want to draw your attention to, you kind of mentioned this, is why would the Big Ten not just simply say to Nebraska, all right, Nebraska, you know what? If you want to play non-conference games, go ahead and do that. We just can't play as a conference, because here's the reality. The Big Ten, they represent a lot of different universities. They represent Rutgers, which is right there in New Jersey, pretty close to New York City. They also represent Northwestern University, which is in Chicago. Big city. I got to tell you, those are worlds apart from Lincoln, Nebraska. So why are they telling people in Lincoln, Nebraska, you can't play your football games there because we're afraid of what's going to happen in New York City? I mean, they are worlds apart. And so I just think this is an example of legal bullying.
Yeah. And I do. I mean, I know that some professional sports leagues have kind of transported themselves into a bubble and said, okay, we're going to take over, not take over the city of Orlando, but we're going to all transplant ourselves to a couple of hotels. We're going to essentially rent out these hotels and rent out this stadium, and that's where we're going to play our season. And, you know, you can't really do that with college athletes. Like, obviously they're supposed to be getting an education.
Right.
And there is an issue with having to travel. And I totally understand, like, putting all of these individuals on a plane or a bus to travel to games and then sending them back to campus where they live in dorms and close contact with a lot of other people. It could affect other students' well-being. So it is more complex in the college, in the context of like collegiate sports. And I do understand that, but, you know, I feel like there might've been, I guess a compromise or a medium in between the two extremes that could have been worked out here that would have allowed student athletes to play. And yeah, I mean, going back to the litigation issue, I just wonder how much the threat of litigation from parents. I mean, I know parents are still involved, and it might be, you know, we want to ask ourselves as a society too, like, are parents over-involved in their adult children's lives? Because, I mean, I don't know that many 18 to 22-year-olds, but I also feel like the ones I do know, like, wouldn't be that apt to, like, sue their school if they got sick, but parents might be. And, you know, if we want younger adults to start acting like adults and having some agency over their lives and making decisions, like, the only way to do that is to let them make these decisions and let them take responsibility for themselves. And I think a lot of times, like, parents kind of clutch onto that fear of what might happen to them. And it's, you know, I don't want to judge anyone. I don't have a college age kid. I don't have a college athlete in my family, so I'm not in the position, but I am in the position of sending my kids back to their schools, and you know, it's unsettling. But
it's not risk-free to send your kid back to school, but we are doing it. I'm even coaching tennis. We are doing that. Now, this is different than in the spring. In the spring, there was a lot of unknown. We didn't know about this virus. It was brand new on the world. We wanted to see how it impacted the world. We know a little bit more now, and I don't think the vast majority of the population is willing to say now, yeah, let's just cabin up. Let's just hold up for the next 2 years until we figure this thing out. We'll just go ahead and give up our lives for the next 2 years. We're not willing to do that. That's not the American way or the American spirit. We know the risk. We say, you know what? We're willing to accept those risks. You give us the waiver. We'll sign off on it. We want to go on with our lives. I know, for example, my son, he has trained his entire life, at least it seems that way, for tennis. And now he will be a senior in high school. He wants to play tennis. This is his senior year. And so why not let him? Is there risk to him? I guess in some remote, minuscule way. But yeah, he wants to accept that risk. And by the way, we have been playing tennis throughout this pandemic. It is actually the best sport, the least amount of contact. Maybe running is a little bit safer. I don't know, but it is a really good sport. All right. Well, there you go. That is you know what? You make a very good therapist. I feel better about myself already.
I'll send you my bill.
Yes, you have shown a proper amount of empathy, and so I am feeling better. But this is a great segue into a recent Supreme Court decision this last week. They declined to take up a case or to issue a stay in a case involving paying student athletes compensation in the educational context. What happened in this particular case? The Ninth Circuit entered an order basically saying that schools, universities, when they limit their pay for students in the educational context, that violates the antitrust law. And so this was an injunction case. And so it's going to go back for a full trial on the merits. But while the case is going on, the universities are going to be allowed to pay students, and the NCAA cannot prohibit that. And we're talking about pay within the educational realm. So in other words, stipends, room and board, things like that. Do you have a take on this decision by the Supreme Court not to stay this order?
Well, I mean, I know it's just, I believe it's Justice Kagan who reviews these kinds of requests from the Ninth Circuit.
Right.
She's like in charge of the Ninth Circuit. So she made the decision and she did not submit it to the full court, which means she didn't really think it was a close call. And I know it's pretty tough to get, there was a pretty tough, I guess, burden in this case. So maybe, wasn't a close call. I mean, I don't have strong feelings. I feel like, if that's what colleges and universities want to do, and that's what the market kind of demands, I don't really have a problem with quote unquote paying student athletes in kind, as long as it's related to the education. Now, if they're getting sponsorships and salaries, that's a whole nother issue. But, I'm a big fan of education. Like, I'm all for it. Like, give them all the education they want. So,
yes,
it doesn't really strike me as problematic, but I also am not the most informed person on this particular issue. So take it with a grain of salt.
Right. Going forward, here's going to be kind of the rule, at least as it exists. And this is actually a hotly litigated area. It involves a student athlete's ability to make money off of his name and likeness, and also to receive various benefits at a certain school, like, for instance, stipends, books, room and board, and things like that. Now, the NCAA strictly prohibits and regulates the kind of benefits student athletes can receive. Now, in general understanding, whenever you have a market, and this clearly is a market of student athletes, and you have some decision that says, we are going to control what you are paid or what you receive in being in this market, that is anti-competitive. And there's an antitrust law out there that prohibits those kind of agreements that restrains trade. And so that is the issue before the court. And the court is saying, in kind of a weird decision, that in the world of student athletes, so we're talking about amateur athletes, in that world, you still cannot have anti-competitive rules. And so it's somewhat of an oxymoron, and it's a case that we are going to have to follow. All right, now I want to transition to something that I know you are excited about, and I'm sure we're going to have some fun discussions throughout the next 90 days. I am talking about your new vice presidential candidate on the Democratic ticket, but because I am horrible at pronouncing names, why don't you go ahead and give us her name?
Kamala Harris.
Kamala Harris. See, I was going to butcher it again. I cannot say it. I want to say Kamala. But tell me why you know it is that way.
Well, I guess I like to think of it is I know that Kamala Harris is a stepmom, and I'm really excited about that because I'm also a stepmom. So like stepmom for VP, and I know that there are... There is no one, and you'll never convince me otherwise, there is no one who is a tougher cookie than a stepmom. You're just going to have to trust me on that one. So that speaks a lot to her character from the jump for me. But I know that her stepkids, she has two stepkids. I think they're like adult stepkids at this point. But they their nickname for her is Mamala.
Mamala.
So it rhymes with Kamala.
Kamala, Mamala. So if I just think of mom, stepmom, Mamala Harris, Kamala Harris, that's how to pronounce her name. Now, already, obviously, this has been a hot button issue. We're trying to take the legal perspective on these various issues out there in the world. And so one of the legal issues with Kamala Harris is her threat to pack the Supreme Court with justices. Did you hear about that threat that she made when she was running for president?
So I would not characterize it as a threat. My understanding is that I think it was the New York Times, but I could be wrong, was conducting like a poll or a survey of all of the Democratic primary candidates. And they were asking questions, and then they were publishing like which candidates answered yes or no to these questions. And one of the questions was, would you be open to the idea, to exploring the idea of adding more justices to the Supreme Court? And just for the record, like, and I'm not defending this. I don't think it's a good idea. I don't want more justices, and I would be opposed to that policy position. But most of the candidates did answer yes, that they would be open to it, and only a few, including
Democratic
Joe
candidates,
Biden, actually.
These were only Democratic candidates.
Correct.
Okay, all right.
Correct. Only the Democrats. So most of them said yes, they would be open to it. Only a few said no, one of whom was Joe Biden. So I really think this is kind of like a red herring, and to me, it kind of underscores the fact that, like, if this is what you're going to characterize as, like, how threatening she is, you're kind of scraping the bottom. Like, obviously, you have a strong candidate. Like, that's what you're going to hang your hat on. So that's my perspective on that.
All right, well, let's unpack the legal issues with that threat, / unthreat, or maybe just a statement that this is what I will do or could do. Let's unpack that here. So under the Constitution, which is our controlling document, it controls how our laws operate. It might surprise some of our listeners to know it is silent as to the number of justices that would be on the Supreme Court. It does set the number of senators, things like that, but it does not set the number of justices. It could be one, it could be 100. It does not matter. All it says is there shall be one Supreme Court and then as many inferior courts as Congress shall so establish. And so they actually could do this. It just simply takes an act of Congress signed by the president to determine the number of justices. So I'm just curious, Mackenzie, do you know? Well, just take a guess. What do you think has been the fewest number of justices?
I mean, the fewest that I can think of from like history class is 6, but I don't know the answer to that.
I think it got down to 5 at one point, but at the beginning it was 6. Now, how dumb was that? 6 justices? Can you imagine if you had 6 justices today? You would have 3-3 ties on everything. How would they break the tie? Maybe that'd be a good thing. I don't know. You'd have to have a good broad swell support on matters before it was passed or whatever is approved by the Supreme Court. But yeah, it was. I believe it got as low as 5 and as high as 15. Now this became an issue. I believe it's 1879, the Judiciary Act. It set it at 9. It's been 9 ever since. Now, during FDR's time, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he, of course, his big deal was the New Deal. And the Supreme Court kept ruling that the New Deal, these particular pieces of legislation, were unconstitutional. It violated the Commerce Clause. Well, FDR said, oh, really? That's what you think? Well, then we're just going to up the number of justices. I'm going to put 5 new justices on the court, and then they will approve my New Deal. And so do you know what happened next, Mackenzie?
I know that another Justice Roberts, Justice Owen Roberts, kind of switched his vote. I guess he was kind of a swing vote on the court, but switched his vote to side with the liberal justices, approve like major New Deal legislation. And they call it, I think, the switch in time that saved 9, because it saved, you know, the 9 justice Supreme Court.
Exactly. And so this has been threatened before, but since I believe 1879, it has remained unchanged at 9, somewhat of a sacred cow. I do think that also plays a role today in how the court operates. I think that Chief Justice John Roberts is very concerned about the court appearing to be political. So they go out of their way to try to vote down the middle. I do believe that is a political decision. But because they're trying to go down the middle, it has the appearance of being apolitical. And I think that is very important to the court. And so that way, I don't think you're going to see the 9 disturbed. Any thoughts on the thought of expanding the court beyond the 9 justices?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it, you know, already there's a public perception about Obama judges and Trump judges and politics in the judiciary. And I think it would just make it so much worse. I think it's a terrible idea. And in my view, you know, what the problem really derives from and what the root of the problem is the fact that Congress, and this is like, I sound like a broken record. I feel like every episode we do, I'm like, Congress is terrible.
Right.
But, you know, Congress, unfortunately, with filibustering judicial nominees and things like that, Congress has made this process way more political than it ever should have been. I think Susan Collins was correct when she made her statement about what the meaning of the terms advice and consent should mean.
And what did she say?
She said, you know, the Senate's job, as it's stated in Article 1, is to provide advice and consent. And that doesn't mean, you know, if there is a qualified candidate, it doesn't mean you get to say as a senator, I don't like that person's politics, I don't like their political position, so I'm going to vote no. It's yes, they meet the qualifications. That is consent. And if the president seeks advice, you can provide advice too. Like, who are some good names that we should, you know, that I should consider?
Right.
Anyone else? But in terms of the consent portion, you know, it's not overriding the president's judgment, it's consent. So, you know, I tend to agree with that. I think, you know, in my view, if Mitch McConnell and the Republicans had never obstructed the Merrick Garland nomination, someone who was indisputably qualified, well qualified, right? We probably, and I'm not blaming, you know, Kamala Harris's answer to a poll question on Mitch McConnell, but I'm just saying, like, I don't think we'd be here in terms of the environment. I think that was a dereliction of the duty of advice and consent. I think it was a travesty, and I think it really affected, you know, the ability of the judiciary to remain independent, or to perpetuate the
appearance
of independence.
Now, wait a second. Now, I cannot let you back up to Merrick Garland. I'm going to back you up further to Justice Robert Bork. That, yeah, you know, back, I believe, is 1987. And that was the origination of the term being Borked, because the Senate did not want him to be confirmed. And so they sandbagged him, attacked him, unjustifiably so, because they did not like his jurisprudence and how he might rule on particular cases. I'm going to back up before Merrick Garland and put the blame at the Senate during Robert Bork's confirmation proceedings. So just because you brought it up, you know what the vote was for your hero, RBG? She was nominated by Bill Clinton to be a Supreme Court justice. And let me tell you, she came with some serious baggage. She was former general counsel for the ACLU. So you got to believe the conservatives did not want her on that bench. They knew how she was going to rule 100% against the conservative viewpoint on all those cases. So even though she was such a hotly controversial nominee, do you know what the vote was?
I mean, it had to be like 99-1 or something.
I'm going off the top of my head. I'm going off the top of my head. I think it was 97-0. For some reason, I think three were not there. It was near unanimous.
Yeah.
And so there was no contention. It's like, all right, so who is playing dirty here? Is it the liberals or the conservatives? I'm just going to leave that one there for people to deliberate. Do you have any kind of retort to that? Or do you want to just leave that as it is?
No, I mean, that's fair enough. Those are two totally fair points. And I, you know, accept that those are facts that occurred. And I don't, you know, I don't. It's not like the narrative is what I want it to be in my head, and I'm only looking at facts right that support it. Those things did happen, and I agree. And for, you know, conservative nominees, it was also, the votes were near unanimous until fairly recently with the outlier of the Bork nomination. And, you know, and yes, that did happen, and it didn't help. And it was probably a dereliction of duty. I do think in the past, you know, decade or so, we've fallen very far, very quickly. And I guess my point is, I don't think that packing the Supreme Court would serve the ends of an independent judiciary, the public's confidence in the judiciary. I don't think, and you know, that, and also the inability of Congress to create policy, which is Congress's job, not a Supreme Court's job. So I don't think it would be good for our country at all. I disagree with Kamala Harris on that issue. But also, you know, I know that Joe Biden responded the opposite way.
Right.
So I really don't think it's like a threat of something that's actually going to happen. But I could be, I've said things that were wrong before, but I wouldn't be worried about it. It's not one of my top 10 concerns. Let's put it that way.
Well, it is interesting because the way things look now, the Democrats are probably going to have the House and they're probably going to get the Senate. And if they also win the presidency, then they can impact the court if they want to. So expect more opinions right down the middle. All right, which leads us to our next case, which is a fascinating case. This is the, I know you saw this last week. The DOJ sent a letter to the Yale University saying that they illegally discriminated against Asian Americans and white applicants during the admissions process. What is your take on that that letter?
I'm not a big fan of this Justice Department, actually. Well,
okay.
I should say I'm not a big fan of the top-tier leadership. I'm not a big fan of Bill Barr. I don't want to say I'm not a fan of the Justice Department. There's a lot of really hardworking, you know, career civil servants that don't deserve to be grouped together with, you know, the actual political appointee of whom I am not a fan. I think it's a very interesting issue.
Why do you think this is interesting? Because you brought up some fascinating points to me in our prep session that I really hadn't thought of. Now, why does this particular case interest you?
So, as we all know, Yale is a private university. And there is some really prominent, famous jurisprudence from the Supreme Court about affirmative action. And those cases came out in the early 2000s, and they had to do with admissions policies at the University of Michigan undergrad and the University of Michigan Law School. And as far as I'm aware, and I don't litigate in this area, but as far as I'm aware, there's still good law, and that's still the precedent in this area. And you know, basically the court took its time and really dissected these admissions policies and determined that, you know, while colleges, public universities are not allowed to just have simply have a quota system or allocate a bunch of points to someone based on their race or national origin.
Right.
At the same time, there is a compelling state interest in maintaining a diverse student body at a public university, you know, a community that reflects the society at large in terms of demographics. And in
let's just back up.
I want to back up here
to make sure our listeners are paying attention to what you just pointed out. I believe the case was Grutter v. Bollinger, something like that. But it dealt with a state university. Now, under the Constitution, it really restricts and applies to state action. In fact, you know, the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law. And so it deals with state action, not necessarily private conduct. And so the cases involving affirmative action all dealt with state universities. Can the state, favor one race over another race when it comes to the admissions process? And as you just pointed out, there is a compelling governmental interest for state universities to accurately reflect the racial demographics of the area. But as you point out, Yale is private. And so are those same interests going to apply as to a public university to a private university? Will the same rules apply? I agree with you, McKenzie. That is a fascinating distinction. How will the court deal with that issue? All right, was there anything else fascinating about this case?
Well, I mean, I guess so. Yeah, in the Gratz decision, which I think Grutter and Gratz came out at the same time.
Right.
I think Gratz had to do with the undergrad policy, which was struck down as unconstitutional. It was discriminatory because they just were allocating like points to people based on their race, and that was no good. But the law schools, University of Michigan law schools admissions policy, kind of, they didn't ignore race. It wasn't race blind. But it also, you know, just looked at individual students and kind of took a holistic approach, and it was narrowly tailored, the court found, to furthering the compelling government interest.
Right.
I think in this case, the allegation or the argument is that, you know, in the public university cases, we were talking about the Fifth and 14th Amendments. Like, we're talking about equal protection of the laws. Here, the argument is that Yale's admissions policy violates, I believe it's Title VI,
right,
of the Civil Rights Act, which is not the Constitution. It's a statute to which Yale is subject, I guess, because they receive a certain amount of federal funding or whatever. But I think the language of the statute is different. We're not talking about equal,
right,
protection of the laws. We're talking about discrimination based on race. And then I think you have to ask yourself, what is discrimination? Is considering race as one factor in an admissions policy, is that discriminatory? And, you
right.
know, I don't know the answer to that because I haven't read the cases. I don't know, you know, what the definition is under the law. But in my view, like, you are not, nobody's entitled to go to Yale, right? So no one's being deprived of something, of a right, of something to which they are entitled.
Right.
So there's that. But also, you know, I would have to look at the intricacies of the admissions policy to determine, you know, if they're taking stacks of applications from certain racial demographics and like throwing them in the trash because, oh, these are all Asian kids, like, let's throw them away. Like, that's obviously, no one wants that
right.
to be happening. But because it's a private university, on the other hand, it's like, you know, let the market kind of sort that out and people will realize how gross that is Yale will lose its reputation and people won't want to go there anymore. So it's a tough, I think it's much more nuanced and complicated in the context of a private college.
Yeah, these are going to be great legal issues. Now, in the public employment or the public university context, the rule was you could not have quotas. So you can't simply say, hey, well, look, you know, 30% of the people at this university have to be from this particular race, and, you know, 50% to be from this race, or whatever. You can't have hard quotas. And so how the universities got around that was by saying, look, we don't have hard quotas. We just use race as one of the criteria amongst many different criteria. So that's kind of how they get around it. I think that's somewhat of a hook in a mirror or smoke and mirrors. I do think that it's somewhat dishonest. I think it is a race-based decision and process. But nonetheless, will that system now be applied in the private context? Will this destroy affirmative action in the private sphere? It's going to be a fascinating legal issue. But Mackenzie, come on, let's be real here. We're trying to have an honest podcast. We can't ignore the politics of this letter, right? I mean, this came out 3 months before an election, and there was a response from Yale saying we were still in the process of gathering information, i.e. they wanted to stall this until after the election, maybe a change in administration. Do you think this letter is political?
Yes. I mean, I think it's obviously and transparently political. And I think, you know, it's another example of the short-sightedness that politics can sometimes encompass. Like, what really is the Justice Department trying to accomplish here? Because if we hold Yale to whatever standard they're trying to say that Yale needs to be held to under Title VI, then don't we need to hold all private colleges to that standard?
Yes.
Aren't all when I go to a public school, like there's a government interest, there's a state school, and the government has an interest, and you know that has been adjudicated, right? But private schools could be all different types of private schools. What if I choose to go to a private school because I want to go to Brigham Young, because I want to go to a Mormon school, or what if I want to go to MIT because, well, neither of these places will probably ever let me in, but I'm not smart enough to go to these places. But if I want to go to MIT because I want to be an aerospace engineer one day, like the MIT's compelling interests, so to speak, might be very different from a Brigham Young, might be very different from a small liberal arts school in Oregon, might be very different. I mean, you're really going to have very far-reaching consequences. And look, I might not like Yale's admissions policy. It might be grotesque to my values, but I also don't have to go to Yale. No one's entitled to go to Yale. And the subset of the population that this even affects is so small because it's such a competitive school and such a small school. Like, I don't think anyone really has a basis to feel threatened because of Yale's admissions policy. I mean, there are very few people who really are going to be affected by that, if at all. And they are people, I believe, that, you know, if you weren't accepted at Yale, quote unquote, because you were white, you know, it's a very tough argument to sell to me that you're really going to suffer in life and you're going to have this horrible life because you couldn't go to Yale, because someone with the credentials to even be competitive to go to Yale is going to succeed in life. Like, you're going to go to a good school. You're going to, you know, you're not going to lose much. Like a Yale degree versus a Cornell degree versus a UPenn degree, you're going to be all right. Like, calm down. That's just the way I feel.
Exactly. I could not agree more. I went to the Mid-America Nazarene University for my undergrad. My law school is the University of Kansas. And and now I'm cracking jokes during CLEs and doing podcasts, so it's all worked out well for me. Well, nonetheless, that was this week's debriefing of the law. And this particular case, we're going to be following this case because this is going to be a precedent-setting case if it continues. I do have this feeling it might be long gone and forgotten after 3 months if the election goes a certain way. But if the election goes a different way, then it might have some staying power. It might radically change the law as it deals with the private realm. So thank you so much, Mackenzie, for joining us this week. Hey, I'm going to give you a little bit of homework for next week. Can I do that?
Sure.
All right, so here's the homework. I want to start talking during the next podcast about class action lawsuits. I've done a lot of research on these interesting, crazy cases. One case that I found that's out there, it deals with, it was a class action lawsuit filed against Subway claiming that their foot-long sub sandwiches are not actually a full 12 inches. And so have you heard about that case?
I actually have. I think it was pretty out there in the news. Yeah.
Here's what we're going to do. This week, I'm going to go to Subway, and maybe if you can go to Subway as well, let's measure how long the foot-long sub sandwich actually is, and then we will compare our notes next week. Does that work for you?
I mean, I'll measure someone else's, I guess, but I'm from Philly. You are not going to get me to eat a Subway hoagie, like, any day of the week. Sorry.
I don't have to eat it. That is an insult. Oh, no. You have your own Philly cheesesteaks there. They are delicious. All right, we'll cover that here next week. And at least I'm going to go out and measure it because you know what? I might be a plaintiff and I might need a lawyer if it's not a full 12 inches. We'll unpack that case and maybe some other class action lawsuits in our next podcast. So thank you so much, Mackenzie, and have a great week.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a mess. Our marketing team, Redbird Solutions, and Leanne Holmberg for spreading the good word about us. Sean Wynn and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. And Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.